This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
Hello, this is Gary Clinton again, and I'd like to welcome you to the 38th iteration of Night Transmissions. Tonight, we're going to start off with an episode from the highly successful radio series Escape, which was broadcast on CBS between July the 7th of 1947 all the way to August the 25th of 1954. With its distinctive theme, an arrangement of Majorski's Night on Bald Mountain, the show was intense fun from beginning to end, and rarely a slow or dragging program. Tonight, we're going to run a program from July the 7th of 1949, The Fourth Man. By the way, this story has no relationship whatever to the 1983 horror movie of the same name. This Fourth Man is based on a 1917 short story by John Russell, which, by the way, the full text of is available at the Night Transmissions website. Just go to www.nighttransmissions.com, then either go to Show 38 or just click on the navigation button that says PDF file. Scroll down to Russell John, The Fourth Man, and you'll be presented with the choice of a PDF file or an e-book in the MobiBook, the PRC file format.
You are drifting on the glossy surface of a burning tropical sea, trapped aboard a flimsy raft, with three murderous companions from whom you cannot escape.
We offer you Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure. Tonight, we take you to New Caledonia in the South Pacific, not far from the town of Noumea, a French penal colony as notorious as Devil's Island, and a trip that staggers the imagination, as John Russell told it in his gripping tale, The Fourth Man.
The raft stood to open sea. A mat of pandanus leaves served for its sail and a paddle of wood for its helm. Its flooring was woven of reeds and bamboo sticks and rested on triple rows of bladders. It was light, elastic, fit to ride any weather, and it carried four men. Three of them sat huddled together at the far end. Their bodies were blackened with dried blood. The hair upon them was long and matted. They wore only the rags of convicts' blue canvas uniforms. On wrist and ankle, they carried their mark, the dark, wrinkled stain of the manacles. There was DuBose, doctor, leader, man of the world, murderer.
Friends, the thing is done.
And Fenarou, forger, ladies' man, weakling, coward.
Yes, we got away all right.
And the one known as the parrot, thief and cutthroat.
So far, so good.
And by way of celebration, gentlemen, may I offer you cigarettes?
Cigarettes? Oh, doctor, you are a marvel, a magician. Oh, look at them, white and fresh as though they had just come from the package.
How did you do it?
Every 6 months, there are about 75 escapes from Noumea. Not more than one succeeds. Ours would be that one, I knew. And so 3 weeks ago, I bribed the night guard for these very cigarettes so that we might sit here, my friends, as we are doing, and celebrate.
I want a light.
Ah, a light for the parrot.
Our doctor's a wonder. He thinks of everything. He gives us cigarettes, matches, and our freedom.
Wait till you've got your 2 feet on the pavement again. That will be the time to talk about freedom.
Oh, to wear starched collars again. To stroll with a girl, clean and fresh from a bath, down the Place de la Concorde, the Rue de
Rivoli. Suppose we get a storm?
It's not the season of storms.
Just the same. Suppose we get a storm.
Parroquet, my friend, you must not be so impatient. We were convicts back there, festering in oblivion. Now we stand on the rosy threshold of the big round world again. We are men raised from the dead.
Suppose we get a storm. You've got the gift for speech, Doctor. But where is the ship that was going to meet us here?
This is the day is agreed. It will meet us.
This wind will blow us to China if we keep on.
We can't lie any closer to shore. Don't forget there's a government launch at Torian. I doubt if the native trackers have given us up.
Careful, parrot. They'll eat you yet.
I have heard about that. Is it true, Doctor, that the natives keep all the runaways they can capture to fatten on?
They prefer the reward. Still, I doubt if they've entirely lost the habit of cannibalism.
Piece by piece, parrot. If first they'll sample you, and then they'll make a stew of your brains. They won't miss a thing.
Shut up, you! The filthy brutes.
I almost forgot. We have one of them with us.
The fourth man was steering the raft. He sat crouched in the stern, his huge, dark hands holding the steering paddle. He was motionless, like an idol, his eyes on the empty sea. The fourth man on the raft.
You are looking at a Kanak, my friends. You will see nothing superior, no line of beauty to redeem the low angle of the forehead, the knobby joints of the body. Nature has stamped him with the mark of inferiority. And he's set the final seal himself, with that twist of bark about his middle and that prong of pig ivory through his nose.
Nonetheless, he is a man. And there's a price on our heads. He could be taking us where he liked.
Calm yourself, Fenero. This is a very simple animal, an infant, really.
Does that mean he couldn't double-cross us?
It does. He's bound by his duty. I made my bargain with his chief up the river. And this one is sent to deliver us on board our ship. That's the only interest he has in us.
And he'll do it?
He will. That is the nature of the native.
I don't trust him. Not for a minute.
The brute. The animal. You! It's you I'm talking about, you filthy brute!
Save your breath, parrot. He speaks no language, only a few noises, a few signs.
I don't feel right on the same raft with that.
Me? Me, I'll just stretch out a little under these mats.
Yes, we should all sleep a little, conserve ourselves. And when we awake, she'll be there, the ship, our saucy little topsail schooner, her mast standing out against the sky. We'll be on our way to France. Sleep, my friends.
The two younger convicts dozed under the heat of the day, but not Dr. DuBose. He stood once again to sweep the skyline under his shaded hand. His plan had been so careful, so precise. He had counted absolutely on meeting the ship. The small schooner, one of those flitting, half-piratical traders of the Copra Islands that can be hired like cabs in a dark street for any sinister enterprise. But there was no ship. And there was no crossroads where one might sit and wait.
Uh, Good morning, Doctor.
It's afternoon, General.
Yes, it is. I slept like a corpse.
And where is the ship, Doctor? It was going to be there when we woke.
I'm thirsty. Dying with thirst.
So are we all, Fenelon.
Where's the flask? I'm roasted in the sun.
We'll have to roast some more. This crew is put on rations.
What are you talking about? Where is that water?
I have it here.
Yes, sir, you have. You think it is yours?
It is ours, Parrot.
I want a drink, Doctor.
Think a little, Parrot. Now, we have to guard our supplies like reasonable men. We don't know how long we may be floating here.
So that's how you talk now. You don't know how long. But you were sure enough when we started.
I am still sure the ship will come. She cannot stay for us in one spot. She'll be cruising to and fro until she intercepts us. We must wait.
That's good. Wait. And in the meantime, what? Fry here in this heat, our tongues hanging out, while you deal us out drop by drop.
Perhaps.
No, the man does not live who can feed me with a spoon. Laugh, you scum! But you're in this too, Veneru, with this captain who thinks of everything and still puts to sea without provisions. Go on, laugh again.
I wasn't laughing, Parrot.
True.
A bad piece of work for a captain of runaway.
Unless she would die very speedily, we must guard our water.
And whose fault is it?
Mine. I admit it. What then? Here we are and here we must stay. We can only do our best with what we have.
All right, Doctor. Do your best. Give me a drink.
You may have your share, of course. But be warned. When it's gone, don't come to us, to Fenelon and me.
What is fair is fair.
My drink.
Very well.
A thimbleful. One thimble.
This way, we should have enough for 3 days, maybe more. With equal shares among the three of us.
Yes, that's right. There are only three of us.
Were you thinking of him, Fenelon, of our pilot? He looks somewhat like us, doesn't he? But his body has never known clothes or his feet shoes. His mind has never known a single thought. Look at us three, gentlemen. You, Fenelon, a forger. You, Parrot, a thief. I, Dr. Dubose, a murderer. Yet we are civilized men. This is a savage animal. Our provisions are only for men.
The three men awoke to their second day on the raft. They looked and saw the far round horizon, the empty desert of the sea, and their own shadows that slipped slowly before them over its smooth, slow heaving. The land had sunk away from them in the night. A trap had been sprung. As the savage sun kindled upon them with the power of a burning glass, a calm fell, an absolute calm. The air hung weighted. The sea heaved and fell in polished undulations, and the sun shone. They crawled to the shelter of their mats, gasping, shriveling, while the fourth man, the savage, the beast, sat silent and unmoving. The water, the world of water, was slack and thick as oil.
How lonely it is.
Dr. Dubose, where is your ship? Your saucy little schooner. Those were your words. Well, where is it?
It will come.
Suppose your friends leave you to rot here, Doctor. Leave Parrot and me to rot here. That would be a joke, eh, Doctor? To wait for a ship that will never come.
It will come. My friends will not fail me.
Why? How do you know, eh? How can you be so sure?
There is a safety vault in Paris full of papers to be opened at my death. Those papers contain confessions. No, gentlemen, no. My friends will come. They will come. That savage Canuck.
Huh? What?
He does not join us. He does not look at us. He sits on his heels in the way of the native with his arms hugging his knees. He sits at the stern, motionless under the shattering sun, gazing out into vacancy. Whenever I raise my eyes, I see nothing else, only this Canuck.
He seems to be enjoying himself quite well.
Yes, I was thinking so myself.
The cannibal. The savage.
He doesn't seem to suffer.
How does he do it? Has he no feelings?
I've been wondering. Maybe that his fibers are tougher.
We have had water, and he has not.
And yet, see? His skin is fresh and moist.
And his belly, fat as a football. Don't tell me the savage is thirsty. Is there any way he could steal our supplies?
Certainly not.
Suppose he has his own supplies hidden.
What?
We'll see. Search the rat.
Yes.
Look. Look under the mat.
No, there's nothing here. Nothing.
You were mistaken. He has nothing hidden.
You are wrong about him, Doctor. When you say he has no understanding, there is one thing he knows and knows well. Pain!
Harold, don't hit him. Harold, stop.
There, scum. That will teach you. Not so chipper now, are you? Not so happy with your luck. That will make you feel...
Come back, my friends. Back under the mats. The glare of the sun is not so bad there. Come.
So the days dragged by. The second, the third, and now it was the fourth day. And still there was no breeze, and still there was no ship.
Doctor?
Yes.
What do you stare at?
Savage. Look at him. Look at us. We are dying. Our powers are ebbing.
And him?
Naked, wild, brutish. He has yet to give the slightest sign of complaint or weakness.
Yes. Yes, it's true.
Night he stretches out and sleeps. Through those long hours when we wrestle and fight with despair, he sleeps like a child. Then in the morning, he resumes his place, aft and changed, fixed. A growing wonder.
Doctor, is this a man or a fiend?
A man. It is a man.
No, a miracle.
No, it is a man. A very poor and wretched example of a man. You'll find no lower type anywhere. Look at his cranial angle, the high ears. Heavy bones of his skull. He's scarcely above an ape.
Then what?
He has a secret.
Secret?
But we see him. Every move he makes, every minute. What chance has he for a secret?
What kind of secret?
Oh, I can't say. Perhaps some method of breathing. Some strange posture he uses to cheat the sensations of the body. Such things are known among primitive peoples. Ah, who knows, knows.
We can know. We can find out.
Ask him? Ah, it's useless. He will not tell. Why should he? We scorn him. We give him no share with us. We abuse him. So he falls back on his own expedience. He remains silent as he always has been, as he always will be. He never tells the secrets. They are the means by which he has survived from the depths of time, and by which he yet may survive when all our wisdom is dust.
There are a number of ways of learning secrets. I know them all.
Useless. He could stand any torture you might invent. Saw how he behaved before. No, that's not the way.
Talk. I am tired of all this talk. Kill him and throw him over. Let's be rid of this thing.
We gain nothing.
Then what do you want?
To win. That's what I want. To win. To beat him at the game. For our own sakes. For our own racial pride, we must. To outlast him. To prove to ourselves we are his masters. Be better. Brains by better organization and control. Watch him. Watch him, my friends. So we can trap him. So we can find out and defeat him in the end.
Watch. I'll watch, all right. You old windbag. I am not sleeping anymore and leave you alone with that bottle.
The bottle? The bottle?
I've been meaning to discuss our rations with you.
Have you?
We're running very short. I'm afraid we must take a cut again.
And what are we down to now, Doctor?
Half a thimbleful.
No.
We must keep our wits.
I say no.
And we'll put it to a vote. You say no, I say yes. Then a rule.
Yes. Yes. Anything but give me mine now.
Then it's a half thimbleful for Monsieur Fenelon. Your share, Fenelon.
More. More, or I'll die. No. More.
No more today.
You must. You must. Doctor.
I said no more today.
Look. A ship. A ship.
Where is it? Doctor. The bottle. Yes, the bottle. He's drinking.
Look at him. You killed him with that oar.
What about the bottle?
There's some left. You caught him just in time.
And you caught the bottle just in time.
It seems I did.
And there is no ship. There will be no ship. We are done. Because of you and your dirty promises that brought us here. Doctor, liar, fool.
Don't come any closer. Unless you want this bottle broken over your head.
No, I wouldn't want that.
Just think, parrot, why should you and I fight? We can see this trouble through and win yet.
Yes.
This weather can't last forever. Now, besides, there will be only two of us to divide the water now.
Yes. It is true, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Fenelon kindly leaves us his share, an inheritance. All right. I take mine now. My share. Right now, if you please. Later we will see.
So be it. Here. Your share.
Many thanks. And now, Fenelon's share. To me, please.
As you say.
And now, another good doctor.
Three. And that's enough, Parrot.
No, doctor. Is not enough. Now I take the rest.
Parrot! My arm!
Your arm? I'll kill you if you don't.
Thank you. You see, I have manners, haven't I? And I have wisdom, too. Because I fooled a very wise man. I toast you, doctor. The best man wins. That was a bright idea. The best.
So? The best man wins, huh, Parrot? You forgot I'm a doctor, didn't you? The water you would kill for has killed you. Man cannot go without water for 4 days and drink his fill and still live. Go on, parrot, gasp out your worthless life. While I laugh. The best man always wins, parrot. The best man...
So, the best man wins. Yes, doctor.
Fennel, you...
Forgot my knife, didn't you? My knife.
Forgot me, lying at your feet while you divided my share of the water. Gave me up for dead, did you? But I, Fina, will outlast the two of you. Fina,
the best man,
always wins.
Fina, you fool, the water, it's running out. Barrett,
Come in.
Bad luck, sir. The raft was here all the time, not 10 miles away from us.
Oh, that calm. Such a misfortune. Well, where are they, the passengers?
They're all dead. One is stabbed to death, another his skull crushed, the other fried by the sun. All dead.
Well, then, all the better. They'll cost nothing to feed.
But how?
Hogsheads, my friend. The hogsheads in the afterhold. Fill them nicely with brine, and there we are.
I do not understand.
You're dull, Marteau, very dull. The gentleman's passage was all paid before we left Sydney. I contracted to bring back 3 escaped convicts. Well, so I'll bring them back in pickle. So, if you'll go back, Marteau, and bring them aboard for the trip, I'll be much obliged.
Very well. There is a 4th man on the raft, Captain Canuck. Still alive. What will we do with him?
A Canuck. There's no word in my contract about any Canuck. Leave him there. He's only a savage.
And so Dr. DeBose and Fennero and the parrot went aboard for the long trip to their beloved Paris. Their bodies pitching and rolling gently in the huge vats of brine. On the raft, the 4th man raised his head slightly as a wind freshened from the west. He watched until the schooner turned, shaping away for Australia. Then he spread his sail of pandanus leaves and headed the raft eastward, back toward New Caledonia, back toward home. Feeling somewhat dry after his exertion, the native plucked a hollow reed at random from the rushes on his raft. Slowly, lazily, he stretched himself at full length in his accustomed place at the stern. He thrust the reed down into one of the bladders underneath the raft and drank his fill of sweet water. He had a dozen such storage bladders remaining, built into the floats at intervals above the waterline. Quite enough to last him safely home.
Escape is produced and directed by Norman McDonald. Tonight, we have presented The 4th Man by John Russell, adapted for radio by Irving Ravetch and narrated by Larry Dobkin. Featured in the cast were Joseph Kearns, Ben Wright, and Barney Phillips, with Jack Crucian and Wilms Herbert. Special music arranged and conducted by Wilbur Hatch. This is Tip Corning speaking over CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Yeah, okay. This is the first break for today. I know. You don't need them. But I need them. I guess. Coming up next is a episode from the Diary of Fate for March the 2nd of 1948 called John Carthage. It was the naming convention on this show to use as a title the name of the main and generally rather unfortunate character. In this case, John Carthage is a murderer who, as it is also the convention of this show, gets his comeuppance at the end.
The Diary of Fate. Fate plays no favorites. It could happen to you.
Book 22, page 475.
In the Diary of Fate.
Yes, here it is. The name John Carthage, Doctor of Medicine. In just a moment, John Carthage will awaken from a drug-induced sleep. He is alone in his luxurious mountain lodge. The last few days have been a strain which sapped his energy. A brilliant and almost miraculous piece of surgery performed upon one who had influenced his well-ordered and meticulous existence. And in just a little while, John Carthage will be dead. As I am preparing to write the final entry on his page, John Carthage is bitterly railing against me and his forgetfulness regarding a little thing. Yes, John Carthage, in a very short while, you will realize the true meaning of fate. In a moment, I will read from the record of Dr. John Carthage in The Diary of Fate. Yes, John Carthage, if it were not for a little thing, you would not now be alone in your lodge. And at this moment, aware that for you, the end is certain. While there is still time, I want to go over your page in my diary. It was during the long-planned weekend of your mountain retreat. You and your lovely young wife, Jane, in company with Dr. Baldwin, were awaiting the return of Mason Gray from a hunt. Remember?
John! John, come quickly!
What's wrong? What's the matter?
Outside! Hurry!
What's the trouble, John?
John, look!
Oh, no! Great Scott!
Oh, Mason! Mason, darling! Oh, my precious Mason!
How in the world did he make it? And on the horse, too!
Get a flashlight quickly, Jane. Doctor, help me get him down.
All right. Take a seat, all right?
How awful. His gun must have exploded.
Abdominal. Hemorrhaging badly, too.
Let's cut away the clothing and expose the area, Doctor. Will you get my bag from the station wagon?
Yes. Yes.
We'll curtail hemorrhage and pour supper in the opening.
Yes, John Carthage. That was a very important entry on your page. Everything had been so carefully thought out. And then, something had happened to alter the course of things. To John Carthage, life had been well ordered. His practice was precise and skillful. as once in the beginning, idealistic and humanitarian. But the ideals Dr. John Carthage had as a graduate physician were gradually smothered by a growing prestige. There was the night, John, that you had arrived home late and went to your wife's room. Remember?
Jane, I'd like to speak with you a moment.
I'm so tired. Can't it wait till morning?
No, it can't.
Oh, very well. Now what's bothering?
Mason Gray.
Oh, that again. It's so late. I'm so
Jane,
tired.
Jane, we've got to settle this thing. You must stop seeing Gray having anything to do with him.
Why shouldn't I see Mason? His work on low-cost housing has given me something worthwhile to do. Takes up the endless days and nights of being alone.
Oh, what excellent company you choose. A worthless, unsuccessful, nincompoop architect.
A man of ideals. A man such as you might have been if money and success hadn't gone to your head.
Oh, Tommy Rust. The man's taken you in.
No, he hasn't. When we were married 5 years ago, you wanted to help people. You were going to be a friend of the poor. You were never going to turn away from a sick man because he couldn't pay you a big fee. I think that's why I fell in love with you, John. But you certainly have changed.
I've given you a good life. There's nothing you want that you can't have.
Nothing I can't buy. Except the feeling that I'm of some use to someone. That I'm needed by someone.
Certainly you're not in love with Gray.
I'm not sure. But if I am, you've driven me to it by leaving me alone. You may not know it, but you don't care for me anymore.
You know that isn't true.
How about your outside interests? All the little Marys and Alice's.
Oh, stop.
And the diamond bracelet you gave Mrs. Lynn. That's the only one I know about, but there must be others. John, I want a divorce. I want to make something of my life.
Then you are in love with Mason Gray.
Even if I never saw Mason again, I still want a divorce. I want my freedom.
I can't believe that. You are in love with him, aren't you?
I'll admit we've had a great deal of companionship.
Jane, you'll stop seeing Gray and there'll be no more talk of divorce.
And if I don't do what you say?
You'll stop seeing Gray if I have to ruin him. If I have to run him out of town. He'll never have you regardless of what I have to do to keep you two apart.
I'll answer it the servants are asleep. If you haven't awakened them with your loud talk. Hello?
Is Dr. Carthage there?
Why, he's retiring now. Is it important?
This is Dr. Baldwin.
Oh, yes, Dr. Baldwin. Just a moment, please. John, you better answer.
Hello, Dr. Baldwin.
Hello, Dr. Carthage. Going to bed, old boy?
Hmm? Oh, well, I have a bad headache. Is there an emergency at the hospital?
No, but there is some fine news for you that I thought you might want to hear.
Fine? What is it?
Carthage, I suggested that the governor consult you.
The governor?
Yes, I thought that would wake you up. He will phone for an appointment when he comes down here at the end of the month.
Hey, that's wonderful. I certainly appreciate your thought of me.
Yes, it meant a great deal for you, John Carthage, to have the governor as a patient. Another jewel in the crown of prestige. You went to your room, but the good news did not make you happy. Your hatred of Mason Gray welled up within you until he loomed as a threatening factor which you had to eliminate. Sleep did not come until you had made a decision. It was then that I, Fate, made another entry on your page. You remember the next day at the hospital?
Dr. Stanley called, sir.
Perfect. Dr. Corbin.
Stanley called, sir.
I see Dr. Corbin.
Yes, Dr. Baldwin. I'm sorry.
You must have a serious problem under consideration.
I'm terribly sorry. I didn't notice. I was wrapped up in the problem.
Nothing serious, my boy?
Huh? Oh, no. Case, you know how it is.
Yes. Well, I just wanted to tell you that you had better get some practice with your trigger finger.
What? I don't understand.
Shooting. I'll be able to accept your invitation for a weekend at your lodge, after all.
Oh. Oh, of course, yes. I'm glad to have you.
Surely you hadn't forgotten.
Oh, not at all. How's this weekend?
Good, good, good. Splendid shooting up there, too. Nice crowd you have there. And Jane's an excellent host.
Well, thanks. I guess the whole crowd will be there.
Good, good, Carthage. You know, that fellow Mason Gray. Amusing, these fellows with radical ideas about what sort of living a poor man's entitled to.
Why, I hadn't thought about them. Well, yes, Dr. Baldwin. It's an excellent idea. Having Gray there. Why, he'll account for a great deal of amusement.
So, that's my story, Mason, and I'm afraid that now this is the end.
Suppose I insist upon things. There's been nothing wrong.
Thank you. We've had a splendid friendship, and you've given me an interest in something worthwhile. Before, I felt useless to the entire world, including my husband.
And you got nothing more from our friendship?
Let's be neither romantic nor dramatic, Mason.
Dana, I must say this. As long as John has decided to read something into our association that didn't exist, I must say that in part he does.
Yes, things don't complicate things.
You must have guessed that I like you much more than I should. Say, I love you, and you know you're in love with me.
I don't think I'm in love with anyone. All I want now is freedom to start over. I told John that if I'd never met you, that I'd still want a divorce. Of course, with his ego, he can't see it.
Neither do you.
Please give me just one chance to straighten out my life. I must figure things out. Once I'm free again, I know I can find myself. Until then, it's goodbye, Mason.
It's just as well, John Carthage, that you weren't present at that meeting. You had a plan in mind. A plan that would forever remove the danger of Mason Gray. That plan, however, required the appearance of a conciliatory attitude toward Jane. So that evening, you were different from the overbearing egomaniac you had become.
Jane, it's difficult to speak about last night.
I'd rather not. I haven't changed my mind.
But I must say that I'm sorry, Jane. I spoke in anger and in haste. I spoke from jealousy and the fear of losing you. See, in my own way, I love you very much, darling. I shan't even ask you not to see Gray. All I ask is that you delay your decision a little while. Think things over.
John, if I thought there was the slightest chance that we'd come to an understanding,
There is. Now, please, all I ask is a chance. Why, tomorrow I'm going up to the lodge to prepare for the weekend. We promised Dr. Baldwin and Mason Gray the last time they were up.
Mason Gray?
Yes.
Are you really going to invite him? After everything you said about him? After what you accused
us
of?
I meant what I said. And I'll be friendly with him because I do trust you. Oh, Jane, give me this one chance.
A chance for what, John Carthage? A very pretty speech. And very effective with Jane. But I, fate, knew what was in your mind. That insincere speech about a new start and the hand of friendship. Yes, it was very effective in masking your plan of death for Mason Gray. In your mind, John Carthage, the taking of the life of the man who threatened your home was justified. And you were nervous, highly irritated, when on your arrival at the lodge, you suddenly recalled that it was Gamson, the caretaker's day off. But also, it would give you time to prepare the plan you were perfecting, without other eyes observing your work.
Probably getting run down.
Lead to Lincoln Rick up. Look, that gate's in the crowd. Found it. Ripped the sleeve on my new jacket. What a nasty scratch on my arm, too. I told Gamson time and again that someday a horse would get a nasty cut from those rusty nails. That senile old fool. See. Oh, yes, I remember. Put it in the locker with my saddle. The best shotgun on the market this time. Dad brought down many a fine bird with it. Too bad the breech has cracked. That can be repaired temporarily. No graphite rubbed into the crack. With a heavy loaded shell. It all explode right in the face, Gray.
You did your work well, John Carthage. The gun was certain to explode and kill the one firing it. No one but you knew that it was broken. Yes, it would pass the closest scrutiny. You smiled with self-satisfaction. Then remember that weekend, you successfully restrained your nervousness as you awaited the result of your plan.
What's the matter, James?
I'm worried about Mason. He should have been back long ago.
Nothing to worry about, my dear. The shooting was probably so good he overstayed. But to allay your fears, Jane, I'll walk down the trail a ways and see if I can find any traces.
John! John, come quickly!
What's wrong? What's the matter?
Outside, hurry!
What's the trouble, John?
John, look!
Oh, no. Great God!
Did he make it?
And on the horse. Get him back to life quickly, James. Doctor, help me get him down. Oh, how awful. His gun must have exploded.
Abdominal. Hemorrhaging badly.
Let's cut away the clothing and expose the area.
All right.
Doctor, get my bag from the station
wagon, will you?
We'll curtail hemorrhage and pour sulfur in the opening.
Thanks, Jane. John, you hold the flashlight. Jane, quick. You get John's bag from the station wagon. I'll stay here and help him.
He isn't dead yet. Go get my bag, quick.
Pull the light over here, John, so I can cut away the shirt. We've got to get him to the hospital, quick. There may be a slim chance, but I doubt it.
During the wild ride, your thoughts were mixed, John. Hatred. The hope that Mason would die before reaching the hospital. And bitterness for your wife. Baldwin was mildly surprised at Jane's sudden and open revelation of her love for Mason. And Mason Gray's thoughts were not of this world, for he was in a coma, except for the few seconds he revived sufficiently to gasp out the few words that the gun had exploded. Then the wild ride was over, and they soon had Mason Gray in the operating room. In the surgeon's lounge, you and Baldwin were talking, remember?
John, he might pull through.
I hope so. I feel I'm responsible.
Nonsense. It was an accident. But if anyone can save him, it's you.
I? Why, I can't. Why, look at my hands. I'm so shaken I can't operate. Get Kopak. He's good.
No, he's on vacation. And the only other man I trust is Truist Wordling.
Oh, I couldn't do it. Can't you understand?
More than you think, Father. I don't wish to be embarrassing, but if you pull him through, the brilliant physician saving his friend's life, I think it would be good all the way around.
Yes, I see.
It would be good, you thought. He would appear to do your best. The operation would be a success, but the patient would die. That was your intention as you started the keen search for fragments of the breech block. You wondered what strange quirk caused the gun to explode against the abdomen instead of against the head of Mason Gray, as you had planned. But now you must concentrate.
Pulse. Respiration. Pulse 120. Respiration very shallow. Give him the adrenaline. Giving 1 cc of adrenaline.
The powder burns you excised swiftly. Then the search through the viscera for perforations. There were a number, and each must be neatly trimmed, sutured.
Pulse up to 150, Doctor.
This was your chance to let him die. You'd done about all you could. No one in this room could accuse you. Then your eye caught something. Something in that torn and mangled abdominal cavity. Your voice quickened.
Pulse 165. Give him Carmen.
Now you were your old competent self. Your hands worked like swift machines as you spoke to the assistant surgeon.
Dr. Ralph, I want a piece of that tissue for biopsy.
Yes, John Carthage. You could still look other physicians in the eye proudly. Now you knew that Mason Gray would come out of this operation miraculously healed of a deadly gunshot wound. And your victory was yet not lost. But fate was waiting. Remember when you went back to the lodge that same night?
Jane.
Who? John. I expected you to phone.
I wanted to tell you about Gray. I operated. Barring complications, she'll be all right. She'll recover. It may take some time to convalesce. But...
John, thank you. Oh, I've behaved so miserably for Dr. Baldwin.
Now I'm certain you're in love with Gray.
I didn't want to let this happen, believe me.
Regardless of that, if you still want your freedom, I really won't stop you. But there's one proviso. That you get a quiet divorce in Las Vegas, then marry Gray at once. But I shan't support him. You must move to some other city.
I don't want any of your money.
I hope neither of you will ever regret it.
Honey, this is really wonderful of you to understand.
Please call Jansen. I need a good stiff drink.
He didn't come. Probably in a drunken town. I'll get the drink for
him. Oh, no, thanks. I think I'll go to bed. I don't feel too well.
If you don't mind, I think I'll drive into town.
Tonight?
I'm dreadfully sorry, but... Oh, I'd like to go into the city.
Why be sorry? I understand. Good night, Jane. And goodbye.
Now, John Carthage, you were alone in your mountain lodge, and you could enjoy your secret. For in that operating room, you saw an all too familiar manifestation. It changed your plans completely. You decided to use all of your skills to save Gray, to bring Jane and her love together for a very few months. Then, because of the tiredness and tension, he decided to take enough sedatives to ensure a good sleep. You lay down, expecting to sleep at least 12 hours. But before sleep came, you relived those moments when you took that small bit of tissue from Gray's abdominal cavity to the laboratory. Remember how you examined it carefully under the microscope? The tentative diagnosis you had made was substantiated.
It is. This is better punishment for you than a sudden death. Cancer. Yes, cancer. But symptoms you'll blame on the old wound, then the pain will gradually increase. Having the money, you'll not be able to work. Jane will work for you. Yes. Work to pay the medical bills. Work against fate to buy drugs to ease those pains. The surgery tonight will advance metastasis. I hope not too rapidly. A long and painful illness to you, Mason Gray. And the best of it to Jane.
Now, John Carthage, you are awakening from your drug-induced sleep. And in a short while, you will be dead. You plotted a murder, and you really succeeded. For with proper treatment in the early stages of cancer, Mason might have recovered. But you didn't advise him of his condition, and he will die. Almost 48 hours have elapsed since you went into the barn to get the gun. Slippery leaves, a sagging corral gate, a torn sleeve, and a scratch from a rusty nail. A minor scratch you forgot to take care of because of your interest in planning Mason Gray's death. Now you are fully awake and alone. Except for me, Fate. You try to get up from your bed, but you are paralyzed. You can't move. What is it you are now saying, John Carthage?
Scratch. I'd forgotten. Oh, the pain. I can't call out. Can't reach the phone.
Carthage is dead. The next day, Gamson, the caretaker, found him lifeless in his bed. The victim of Lockjaw. Heed well, you who listen, and remember, there is a page for you in
The Diary of Fate. Produced by Larry Finley. Diary of Fate is a Finley transcription brought to you from Hollywood.
I guess he did get away with it, but I gotta tell you, that was the quickest case of lockjaw I ever heard of. I did a little quick investigation, and generally the first symptoms of lockjaw don't really occur until after the 4th to the 25th day after infection. Fatalities from lockjaw, if left untreated, amount to about 30%. So while none of this is impossible, it's all really quite unlikely. But then, complete believability is not always the strong suit of fiction. No matter what form that fiction takes, whether it be a TV show you saw last night, a movie you're going to see tomorrow, or a radio program that's more than 60 years old. I know. Another break. What can I do? It's a promise to come back soon. Up next is another reading from the LibriVox Project. This time, it's an old Philip K. Dick story. It's so old, in fact, that of the 121 short stories Phil Dick wrote, this is only the second. It was published in 1952 in the September edition of Planet Stories. Dick was an interesting character. He led a very challenging life. His mental health was never particularly strong. In fact, he was institutionalized several times with delusions. At least most of us believe they were delusions. Dick would become paranoid and begin to imagine plots against him by the KGB and the FBI. At one point, he alleged that they were responsible for a burglary of his house from which documents were stolen. He came later to suspect that he might have committed the burglary himself and then forgotten he had done so. After a time, Dick himself speculated as to whether or not he suffered from schizophrenia. Dick's legacy, for most people, can be found in a series of successful adaptations of his stories and books into movies. Those include Screamers in 1995, Total Recall in 1990, Imposter in 2001, Minority Report in 2002, Paycheck in 2003, A Scanner Darkly in 2006, Next in 2007, and of course best known of all was the adaptation of his short story to Android's Dream of Electric Sheep as Blade Runner. In 1982, at the age of 53, Philip Dick suffered a stroke and 5 days later died in Santa Ana, California on March the 2nd. He will be missed.
The Gun by Philip K. Dick. Reading by Greg Marguerite. Nothing moved or stirred. Everything was silent, dead. Only the gun showed signs of life, and the trespassers had wrecked that for all time. The return journey to pick up the treasure would be a cinch. They smiled. The captain peered into the eyepiece of the telescope. He adjusted the focus quickly. "It was an atomic fission we saw, all right," he said presently. He sighed and pushed the eyepiece away. "Any of you who wants to look may do so, but it's not a pretty sight." "Let me look, Tance," the archaeologist said. He bent down to look, squinting. "Good Lord!" He leaped violently back, knocking against Dorley, the chief navigator. "Why did we come all this way, then?" Dorley asked, looking around at the other men. "There's no point even in landing. Let's go back at once." "Perhaps he's right," the biologist murmured, "but I'd like to look for myself, if I may." He pushed past Tance and peered into the sight. He saw a vast expanse of endless surface of gray stretching to the edge of the planet. At first he thought it was water, but after a moment he realized that it was slag, pitted, fused slag broken only by hills of rock jutting up at intervals. Nothing moved or stirred. Everything was silent, dead. "I see," Fomar said, backing away from the eyepiece. "Well, I won't find any legumes there." He tried to smile, but his lips stayed unmoved. He stepped away and stood by himself, staring past the others. "I wonder what the atmospheric sample will show," Tance said. "I think I can guess," the captain answered. "Most of the atmosphere is poisoned, but didn't we expect all this? I don't see why we're so surprised. A fission visible as far away as our system must be a terrible thing." He strode off down the corridor, dignified and expressionless. They watched him disappear into the control room. As the captain closed the door, the young woman turned. What did the telescope show, good or bad? Bad. No life could possibly exist. Atmosphere poisoned, water vaporized, all the land fused. Could they have gone underground? The captain slid back the port windows so that the surface of the planet under them was visible. The two of them stared down, silent and disturbed. Mile after mile of unbroken ruin stretched out, blackened slag, pitted and scarred, and occasional heaps of rock. Suddenly Nasha jumped. "Look, over there at the edge, do you see it?" They stared. Something rose up. Not rock, not an accidental formation. It was round, a circle of dots, white pellets on the dead skin of the planet. A city? Buildings of some kind? "Please turn the ship," Nasha said excitedly. She pushed her dark hair from her face. "Turn the ship and let's see what it is." The ship turned, changing its course. As they came over the white dots, the captain lowered the ship, dropping it down as much as he dared. "Piers," he said. "Piers of some sort of stone, perhaps poured artificial stone. The remains of a city." "Oh dear," Nasha murmured. "How awful." She watched the ruins disappear behind them. In a half-circle, the white squares jutted from the slag, chipped and cracked like broken teeth. "There's nothing alive," the captain said at last. "I think we'll go right back. I know most of the crew want to. Get the government receiving station on the sender and tell them what we found and that we..." He staggered. The first atomic shell had struck the ship, spinning it around. The captain fell to the floor, crashing into the control table. Papers and instruments rained down on him. As he started to his feet, the second shell struck. The ceiling cracked open. Struts and girders twisted and bent. The ship shuddered, falling suddenly down, then righting itself as automatic controls took over. The captain lay on the floor by the smashed control board. In the center, Nasha struggled to free herself from the debris. Outside, the men were already sealing the gaping leaks in the side of the ship, through which the precious air was rushing, dissipating into the void beyond. "Help me," Dorley was shouting. "Fire over here, wiring ignited." Two men came running. Tance watched helplessly, his eyeglasses broken and bent. "So there is life here after all," he said, half to himself. "But how could..." "Give us a hand," Fomar said, hurrying past. "Give us a hand. We've got to land the ship." It was night. A few stars glinted above them, winking through the drifting silt that blew across the surface of the planet. Dorley peered out, frowning. "What a place to be stuck in." He resumed his work, hammering the bent metal hull of the ship back into place. He was wearing a pressure suit. There were still many small leaks, and radioactive particles from the atmosphere had already found their way into the ship. Nasha and Fomar were sitting at the table in the control room, pale, solemn, studying the inventory lists. "Low on carbohydrates," Fomar said. "We can break down the stored fats if we want to, but... I wonder if we could find anything outside." Nasha went to the window. "How uninviting it looks." She paced back and forth, very slender and small, her face dark with fatigue. "What do you suppose an exploring party would find?" Fomar shrugged. "Not much. Maybe a few weeds growing in cracks here and there. Nothing we could use. Anything that would adapt to this environment would be toxic, lethal." Nasha paused, rubbing her cheek. There was a deep scratch there, still red and swollen. "Then... how do you explain it? According to your theory, the inhabitants must have died in their skins, fried like yams. But who fired on us? Somebody detected us, made a decision, aimed a gun." "And gauged distance," the captain said feebly from the cot in the corner. He turned toward them. "That's the part that worries me. The first shell put us out of commission. The second almost destroyed us. They were well aimed, perfectly aimed. We're not such an easy target." "True," Fomar nodded. "Well, perhaps we'll know the answer before we leave here. What a strange situation. All our reasoning tells us that no life could exist. The whole planet burned dry, the atmosphere itself gone, completely poisoned." "The gun that fired the projectiles survived," Nasha said. "Why not people?" "It's not the same. Metal doesn't need air to breathe. Metal doesn't get leukemia from radioactive particles. Metal doesn't need food and water." There was silence. "A paradox," Nasha said. "Anyhow, in the morning I think we should send out a search party, and meanwhile we should keep on trying to get the ship in condition for the trip back." "It'll be days before we can take off," Fomar said. "We should keep every man working here. We can't afford to send out a party." Nasha smiled a little. "We'll send you out in the first party. Maybe you can discover..." What was it you were so interested in? Legumes. Edible legumes. Maybe you can find some of them. Only what? Only watch out. They fired on us once without even knowing who we were or what we came for. Do you suppose they fought with each other? Perhaps they couldn't imagine anyone being friendly under any circumstances. What a strange evolutionary trait. Interspecies warfare. Fighting within the race. We'll know in the morning, Fomar said. Let's get some sleep. The sun came up chill and austere. The three people, two men and a woman, stepped through the port, dropping down on the hard ground below. What a day, Dorley said grumpily. I said how glad I'd be to walk on firm ground again, but... Come on, Nasha said, up beside me. I want to say something to you. Will you excuse us, Tance? Tance nodded gloomily. Dorley caught up with Nasha. They walked together, their metal shoes crunching the ground underfoot. Nasha glanced at him. Listen, the captain is dying. No one knows except the two of us. By the end of the day period of this planet, he'll be dead. The shock did something to his heart. He was almost 60, you know. Dorley nodded. That's bad. I have a great deal of respect for him. You will be captain in his place, of course, since you're vice-captain now. No. I prefer to see someone else lead, perhaps you or Fomar. I've been thinking over the situation, and it seems to me that I should declare myself mated to one of you, whichever of you wants to be captain. Then I could devolve the responsibility. Well, I don't want to be captain. Let Fomar do it. Nasha studied him, tall and blonde, striding along beside her in his pressure suit. I'm rather partial to you, she said. We might try it for a time, at least, but do as you like. Look, we're coming to something. They stopped walking, letting Tance catch up. In front of them was some sort of a ruined building. Dorley stared around thoughtfully. Do you see? This whole place is a natural bowl, a huge valley. See how the rock formations rise up on all sides, protecting the floor? Maybe some of the great blast was deflected here. They wandered around the ruins, picking up rocks and fragments. I think this was a farm, Tance said, examining a piece of wood. This was part of a tower windmill. Really? Nasha took the stick and turned it over. Interesting, but let's go. We don't have much time. Look, Dorley said suddenly, off there, a long way off. Isn't that something? He pointed. Nasha sucked in her breath. The white stones. What? Nasha looked up at Dorley. The white stones. The great broken teeth. We saw them, the captain and I, from the control room. She touched Dorley's arm gently. That's where they fired from. I didn't think we had landed so close. What is it? Tance said, coming up to them. I'm almost blind without my glasses. What do you see? The city, where they fired from. Oh. All three of them stood together. Well, let's go, Tance said. There's no telling what we'll find there. Dorley frowned at him. Wait, we don't know what we would be getting into. They must have patrols. They probably have seen us already, for that matter. They probably have seen the ship itself, Tance said. They probably know right now where they can find it, where they can blow it up. So what difference does it make whether we go closer or not? That's true, Nasha said. If they really want to get us, we haven't a chance. We have no armaments at all. You know that. I have a hand weapon, Dorley nodded. Well, let's go on, then. I suppose you're right, Tance. But let's stay together, Tance said nervously. Nasha, you're going too fast. Nasha looked back. She laughed. If we expect to get there by nightfall, we must go fast. They reached the outskirts of the city at about the middle of the afternoon. The sun, cold and yellow, hung above them in the colorless sky. Dorley stopped at the top of a ridge overlooking the city. Well, there it is, what's left of it. There was not much left. The huge concrete piers which they had noticed were not piers at all, but the ruined foundations of buildings. They had been baked by the searing heat, baked and charred almost to the ground. Nothing else remained, only this irregular circle of white squares, perhaps 4 miles in diameter. Dorley spat in disgust. More wasted time. A dead skeleton of a city, that's all. But it was from here that the firing came, Tance murmured. Don't forget that. And by someone with a good eye and a great deal of experience, Nasha added. Let's go. They walked into the city between the ruined buildings. No one spoke. They walked in silence, listening to the echo of their footsteps. It's macabre, Dorley muttered. I've seen ruined cities before, but they died of old age and fatigue. This was killed, seared to death. This city didn't die, it was murdered. I wonder what the city was called, Nasha said. She turned aside, going up the remains of a stairway from one of the foundations. Do you think we might find a signpost? Some kind of plaque? She peered into the ruins. There's nothing there, Dorley said impatiently. Come on. Wait, Nasha bent down, touching a concrete stone. There's something inscribed on this. What is it? Tance hurried up. He squatted in the dust, running his gloved fingers over the surface of the stone. Letters, all right. He took a writing stick from the pocket of his pressure suit and copied the inscription on a bit of paper. Dorley glanced over his shoulder. The inscription was, Franklin Apartments. That's this city, Nasha said softly. That was its name. Tance put the paper in his pocket and they went on. After a time, Dorley said, Nasha, you know, I think we're being watched, but don't look around. The woman stiffened. Oh? Why do you say that? Did you see something? No, I can feel it, though, don't you? Nasha smiled a little. I feel nothing, but perhaps I'm more used to being stared at. She turned her head slightly. Oh! Dorley reached for his hand weapon. What is it? What do you see? Tance had stopped dead in his tracks, his mouth half open. The gun, Nasha said. It's the gun. Look at the size of it, the size of the thing. Dorley unfastened his hand weapon slowly. That's it, all right. The gun was huge, stark and immense. It pointed up at the sky, a mass of steel and glass set in a huge slab of concrete. Even as they watched, the gun moved on its swivel base, whirring underneath. A slim vane turned with the wind, a network of rods atop a high pole. It's alive, Nasha whispered. It's listening to us, watching us. The gun moved again, this time clockwise. It was mounted so that it could make a full circle. The barrel lowered a trifle, then resumed its original position. But who fires it? Tance said. Dorley laughed. No one. No one fires it. They stared at him. What do you mean? It fires itself. They couldn't believe him. Nasha came close to him, frowning, looking up at him. I don't understand. What do you mean it fires itself? Watch, I'll show you. Don't move. Dorley picked up a rock from the ground. He hesitated a moment and then tossed the rock high in the air. The rock passed in front of the gun. Instantly, the great barrel moved, the vanes contracted. The rock fell to the ground. The gun paused, then resumed its calm swivel, its slow circling. You see, Dorley said, it noticed the rock as soon as I threw it up in the air. It's alert to anything that flies or moves above the ground level. Probably it detected us as soon as we entered the gravitational field of the planet. It probably had a bead on us from the start. We don't have a chance. It knows all about the ship. It's just waiting for us to take off again. I understand about the rock, Nasha said, nodding. The gun noticed it, but not us, since we're on the ground, not above. It's only designed to combat objects in the sky. The ship is safe until it takes off again. Then the end will come. But what's this gun for? Tance put in. There's no one alive here. Everyone is dead. It's a machine, Dorley said, a machine that was made to do a job, and it's doing the job. How it survived the blast, I don't know. On it goes, waiting for the enemy. Probably they came by air in some sort of projectiles. The enemy, Nasha said, their own race. It is hard to believe that they really bombed themselves, fired at themselves. Well, it's over with, except right here where we're standing. This one gun, still alert, ready to kill. It'll go on until it wears out. And by that time, we'll be dead, Nasha said bitterly. There must have been hundreds of guns like this, Dorley murmured. They must have been used to the sight. Guns, weapons, uniforms. Probably they accepted it as a natural thing, part of their lives, like eating and sleeping. An institution like the church and the state. Men trained to fight, to lead armies. A regular profession, honored, respected. Tance was walking slowly toward the gun, peering nearsightedly up at it. Quite complex, isn't it? All those vanes and tubes. I suppose this is some sort of a telescopic sight. His gloved hand touched the end of a long tube. Instantly the gun shifted, the barrel reacting. It swung. Don't move, Dorley cried. The barrel swung past them as they stood rigid and still. For one terrible moment it hesitated over their heads, clicking and whirring, settling into position. Then the sounds died out and the gun became silent. Tance smiled foolishly inside his helmet. I must have put my finger over the lens. I'll be more careful. He made his way up onto the circular slab, stepping gingerly behind the body of the gun. He disappeared from view. Where did he go? Nasha said irritably. He'll get us all killed. Tance, come back, Dorley shouted. What's the matter with you? In a minute, there was a long silence. At last the archaeologist appeared. I think I found something. Come up and I'll show you. What is it? Dorley, you said the gun was here to keep the enemy off. I think I know why they wanted to keep the enemy off. They were puzzled. I think I've found what the gun is supposed to guard. Come and give me a hand. All right, Dorley said abruptly. Let's go. He seized Nash's hand. Come on, let's see what he's found. I thought something like this might happen when I saw that the gun was... Like what? Nasha pulled her hand away. What are you talking about? You act as if you knew what he's found. I do, Dorley smiled down at her. Do you remember the legend that all races have, the myth of the buried treasure and the dragon, the serpent that watches it, guards it, keeps everyone away? She nodded. Well? Dorley pointed up at the gun. That, he said, is the dragon. Come on. Between the three of them, they managed to pull up the steel cover and lay it to one side. Dorley was wet with perspiration when they finished. It isn't worth it, he grunted. He stared into the dark, yawning hole. Or is it? Nasha clicked on her hand lamp, shining the beam down the stairs. The steps were thick with dust and rubble. At the bottom was a steel door. Come on, Tance said excitedly. He started down the stairs. They watched him reach the door and pull hopefully on it without success. Give a hand! All right. They came gingerly after him. Dorley examined the door. It was bolted shut, locked. There was an inscription on the door, but he could not read it. Now what? Nasha said. Dorley took out his hand weapon. Stand back. I can't think of any other way. He pressed the switch. The bottom of the door glowed red. Presently it began to crumble. Dorley clicked the weapon off. I think we can get through. Let's try. The door came apart easily. In a few minutes they had carried it away in pieces and stacked the pieces on the first step. Then they went on, flashing the light ahead of them. They were in a vault. Dust lay everywhere, on everything, inches thick. Wood crates lined the walls, huge boxes and crates, packages and containers. Tance looked around curiously, his eyes bright. What exactly are all these? He murmured. Something valuable, I would think. He picked up a round drum and opened it. A spool fell to the floor, unwinding a black ribbon. He examined it, holding it up to the light. Look at this. They came around him. Pictures, Nasha said. Tiny pictures. Records of some kind. Tance closed the spool up in the drum again. Look, hundreds of drums. He flashed the light around. And those crates. Let's open one. Dorley was already prying at the wood. The wood had turned brittle and dry. He managed to pull a section away. It was a picture. A boy in a blue garment, smiling pleasantly, staring ahead, young and handsome. He seemed almost alive, ready to move toward them in the light of the hand lamp. It was one of them, one of the ruined race, the race that had perished. For a long time they stared at the picture. At last Dorley replaced the board. All these other crates, Nasha said, more pictures, and these drums. What are in these boxes? This is their treasure, Tance said almost to himself. Here are their pictures, their records. Probably all their literature is here, their stories, their myths, their ideas about the universe. And their history, Nasha said. We'll be able to trace their development and find out what it was that made them become what they were. Dorley was wandering around the vault. Odd, he murmured. Even at the end, even after they had begun to fight, they still knew someplace down inside them that their real treasure was this, their books and pictures, their myths. Even after their big cities and buildings and industries were destroyed, they probably hoped to come back and find this, after everything else was gone. When we get back home, we can agitate for a mission to come here, Tance said. All this can be loaded up and taken back. We'll be leaving about... He stopped. Yes, Dorley said dryly. We'll be leaving about 3 day periods from now. We'll fix the ship, then take off. Soon we'll be home. That is, if nothing happens. Like being shot down by... that. Oh, stop it, Nasha said impatiently. Leave him alone. He's right. All this must be taken back home sooner or later. We'll have to solve the problem of the gun. We have no choice. Dorley nodded. What's your solution, then? As soon as we leave the ground, we'll be shot down. His face twisted bitterly. They've guarded their treasure too well. Instead of being preserved, it will lie here until it rots. It serves them right. How? Don't you see? This was the only way they knew, building a gun and setting it up to shoot anything that came along. They were so certain that everything was hostile, the enemy coming to take their possessions away from them. Well, they can keep them. Nasha was deep in thought, her mind far away. Suddenly she gasped. "Dorley," she said, "what's the matter with us? We have no problem. The gun is no menace at all." The two men stared at her. "No menace," Dorley said. "It's already shot us down once, and as soon as we take off again..." "Don't you see?" Nasha began to laugh. "The poor foolish gun. It's completely harmless. Even I could deal with it alone." "You?" Her eyes were flashing. "With a crowbar, with a hammer, or a stick of wood. Let's go back to the ship and load up. Of course we're at its mercy in the air. That's the way it was made. It can fire into the sky, shoot down anything that flies. But that's all. Against something on the ground, it has no defenses, isn't that right?" Dorley nodded slowly. "The soft underbelly of the dragon. In the legend, the dragon's armor doesn't cover its stomach." He began to laugh. "That's right. That's perfectly right." "Let's go then," Nasha said. "Let's get back to the ship. We have work to do here." It was early the next morning when they reached the ship. During the night, the captain had died, and the crew had ignited his body according to custom. They had stood solemnly around it until the last ember died. As they were going back to their work, the woman and the two men appeared, dirty and tired, still excited. And presently from the ship a line of people came, each carrying something in his hands. The line marched across the gray slag, the eternal expanse of fused metal. When they reached the weapon, they all fell on the gun at once, with crowbars, hammers, anything that was heavy and hard. The telescopic sights shattered into bits. The wiring was pulled out, torn to shreds. The delicate gears were smashed, dented. Finally, the warheads themselves were carried off and the firing pins removed. The gun was smashed, the great weapon destroyed. The people went down into the vault and examined the treasure. With its metal-armored guardian dead, there was no danger any longer. They studied the pictures, the films, the crates of books, the jeweled crowns, the cups, the statues. At last, as the sun was dipping into the gray mists that drifted across the planet, they came back up the stairs again. For a moment they stood around the wrecked gun, looking at the unmoving outline of it. Then they started back to the ship. There was still much work to be done. The ship had been badly hurt. Much had been damaged and lost. The important thing was to repair it as quickly as possible, to get it into the air. With all of them working together, it took just 5 more days to make it spaceworthy. Nasha stood in the control room watching the planet fall away behind them. She folded her arms, sitting down on the edge of the table. "What are you thinking of?" Dorley said.
"I? Nothing."
"Are you sure?"
"I was thinking that there must have been a time when this planet was quite different, when there was life on it."
"I suppose there was. It's unfortunate that no ships from our system came this far. But then we had no reason to suspect intelligent life until we saw the fission glow in the sky."
"And then it was too late."
"Not quite too late. After all, their possessions, their music, books, their pictures, all of that will survive. We'll take them home and study them, and they'll change us. We won't be the same afterwards. Their sculpturing especially. Did you see the one of the great winged creature without a head or arms? Broken off, I suppose, but those wings. It looked very old. It will change us a great deal."
"When we come back, we won't find the gun waiting for us," Nasha said. "Next time it won't be there to shoot us down. We can land and take the treasure, as you call it." She smiled up at Dorley. "You'll lead us back there as a good captain should."
"Captain?" Dorley grinned. "Then you've decided?"
Nasha shrugged. "Fomar argues with me too much. I think, all in all, I really prefer you."
"Then let's go," Dorley said. "Let's go back home."
The ship roared up, flying over the ruins of the city. It turned in a huge arc and then shot off beyond the horizon, heading into outer space. Down below, in the center of the ruined city, a single, half-broken detector vane moved slightly, catching the roar of the ship. The base of the great gun throbbed painfully, straining to turn. After a moment, a red warning light flashed on down inside its destroyed works. And a long way off, 100 miles from the city, another warning light flashed on, far underground. Automatic relays flew into action. Gears turned. Belts whined. On the ground above, a section of metal slag slipped back. A ramp appeared. A moment later, a small cart rushed to the surface. The cart turned toward the city. A second cart appeared behind it. It was loaded with wiring cables. Behind it, a third cart came, loaded with telescopic tube sights. And behind came more carts, some with relays, some with firing controls, some with tools and parts, screws and bolts, pins and nuts. The final one contained atomic warheads. The carts lined up behind the first one. The lead cart. The lead cart started off across the frozen ground, bumping calmly along, followed by the others, moving toward the city, to the damaged gun.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one. Next is From the Origin of Superstition, a series that ran in 1935 dedicated to the exploration of where, why, and how various superstitions got their start. Tonight, we deal with superstitions surrounding the blowing out of candles.
Doubled and redoubled. That gives us game and rubber. Well, pay up like a nice little boy, Carter. That lucky charm you drag out every time you play cards evidently wasn't on the job today.
Well, it usually works, but you can't go against bad cards.
Rubbish. You're just plain superstitious.
Maybe I am. Who isn't?
Oh, I guess we all are, more or less.
Well, I'm not. All that rot about breaking mirrors and black cats crossing your path, hand me a laugh. The only sensible superstition I believe in is walking under a ladder. And that's just because I don't care to risk a bucket of paint falling on me.
Telegram for Mr. Charles Carter.
Right here, Porter. Thanks. By Jove, boys, I'm a year older.
Well.
Listen, darling, I'm giving you a birthday dinner with a cake and 30 candles. Hope you can blow them all out. Don't be late. Love. That's from my wife.
There's another silly superstition. Blowing out the candles on a birthday cake.
Yeah, if you don't blow them all out in one breath, it means bad luck. Is that it?
That's it. I remember 2 years ago, I failed to blow out all my birthday candles, and things have been rotten ever since.
Listen, Carter, did you ever hear of the Depression?
Yeah, I guess we all got short-winded on our last two or three birthdays.
Yeah. Say, speaking of blowing out birthday candles, that happened to me once. I was just as superstitious as anyone up to that time.
Why, what happened?
Plenty, I'll say. Porter, where are we?
We've been in San Francisco in 30 minutes, sir.
Okay. I've just got time to tell it.
Shoot the works.
Right. A picture, if you will, a birthday party gathered together in a ghostly house of strange noises and weird shadows. In the center of the table is a huge birthday cake, with candles burning and flickering in the gloom. The clock was striking 7.
Well, Jim, here's to you, and many happy birthdays.
Thanks, thank
you. Everybody drinks that. And also to Jane Dawson, the happy bride.
There you are. Congratulations.
Thanks, everybody. Isn't this a lovely old house? They say it's over 100 years old.
Ooh, but it gives me the creeps with no lights except those from birthday candles. Look at those weird shadows on the wall.
It is sort of spooky.
You say there's no gas or electricity in the house, Jim?
Old Uncle Jeremiah was too stingy to put them in, I guess.
Why, we all thought he was a rich old miser.
So did I. He was my ace in the hole, I being his sole heir. And then when he died and we read the will, this old house was all he had.
And I'm grateful for that much. It enabled us to get married. At least it'll be a roof over our heads, and we own it. Someday when our ship comes in, we'll install a lot of modern conveniences, paint it up, and refurnish it. I was anxious for you to see it, and Jim's birthday seemed to provide the opportunity.
Your uncle was a seafaring man, I've heard.
Yes, that's right. From the way he lived and hid in this old house, one would think that someone was after him.
Oh.
That, I guess it was true. But we found a letter among his papers. Say, I've got it with me. Listen, I'll read it. You got away with the plunder and double-crossed us, Jeremiah Dawson. I know where you're hiding, and when I see you, it will be your throat or the loot. And it's signed, Blodgett. Uncle Jeremiah must have changed addresses several times since that was written.
Why, the old curmudgeon. I say, Jim, I'll bet there's a fortune hidden somewhere in this old house.
Hey, we all thought that, but we've searched the place from cellar to roof.
I've often wondered what Blodgett meant by the plunder. Maybe it was jewels. Strings of pearls.
Or Spanish doubloons. Pieces of 8.
Or a case of pre-war scotch. Well, we've given up all hopes of learning who Blodgett is and what the loot consisted of. I guess Uncle Jeremiah must have used it all up on living expenses. Anyway, it's a mystery we'll never be able to solve.
Well, the dinner's over. Come on, Jim. Blow out your candles.
Ooh, but we'll be in the dark.
Nope, I've got some lamps ready tonight.
Oh, I think this is all just darn foolishness. But just to please my wife, I'll blow a blast that will knock the frosting off the cake.
Now, don't fail, honey. You know, it's bad luck if you leave even one candle burning.
Bad luck, eh? Well, I'm known as the blasting blowhard. Here goes.
Well, I'll be jiggered.
Oh, Jim, you've left one candle burning. Now we're sure to have bad luck.
Oh, don't be silly, that's...
Look! Fire. That shadow. Up there on the balcony against the wall. It's moving.
By Jove, it is. Looks as if someone was creeping along on all fours.
Ooh, I'm all a shivery. Let's get out of here.
Now, quiet. Now, please, everybody, quiet. I'll have a look.
Oh, Jim, no, please.
Listen, Jane, it's probably the magnified shadow of a stray cat. But I'm going to find out.
The shadow's disappeared. There goes Jim. He's on the landing now. Why, he's vanished, too.
I'm all right. Come on now. Get up on your feet or I'll paste you again on that ugly mouth of yours. Light those lamps, Jane.
All right.
You men come over here. We'll tie him up. Here, put that rope around there. There you are, my hearty. Trussed up like Mrs. Maloney's Christmas goose.
Oh.
Now then, my good man. My, isn't that an ugly brute?
Oh, Jim, you sure you're not hurt? Oh,
only a bruised chin, darling.
What's the idea?
That's what we'd like to know. What are you doing here? You realize this is unlawful entry and there's a penalty of a good many years for that in the big house?
Curse me luck. I always was unlucky ever since that devil Jeremiah Dawson double-crossed me.
Say, you're Blodgett.
Sure I am. I say, how did you know?
I'm gifted with second sight. Come on now, explain all this.
Everything was going fine until you showed up with this blasted birthday party. I've been hunting for old Jeremiah for nigh on to 5 years now. Ever since he ditched me and made off with the loot.
Loot?
What? Yeah. And then when I read in the papers that he'd croaked, I knew I was going to be lucky, for I'd located him at last.
What do you mean, lucky?
Why, find the blooming treasure.
Find it? Where?
Why, here, in his home.
Well, what? There isn't any treasure in this house. You came on a fool's errand. We've searched this place high and low.
Well, you don't know old Jeremiah like I did. I knew just where he hid it.
Jim, it's here!
I knew the old miser was rich.
Wait a minute. Well, Blodgett, where is this treasure?
Wouldn't you like to know?
I certainly would, and you're going to tell us. But first of all, where did this loot come from?
A rich South American was on our vessel. He had it in an estate room, Old Jeremiah was first mate and spotted him. When we struck a coral reef and the vessel began to sink, Jeremiah grabbed the Spaniard and chucked him in our boat. We drifted for days, and then the Spaniard and the rest of the crew died. We tossed them all overboard one by one, but Jeremiah had the money.
The money? Money?
Sure, the coin, Masumas, Pondulets, American banknotes. $200,000 in bills.
Great Scott!
And you don't know who it belongs to?
No, ma'am. And no one knew who the Spaniard was. Jeremiah said we would split. And when we was rescued, he done me dirt and bamboozled. I swore to get that money, but he died. And here I was, just about to get my hands on it when you butted in.
Now, wait a minute. You were fussing around an old sea chest. We searched that, but I'm going to look again. Here it is. Now, let's look.
Oh.
Empty.
Oh.
Wait. Wait, what's this? A false bottom?
Is it?
Sure is. There, hold that lamp over here.
Can you see?
Great Scott! Bills! United States money! Jane, we're rich!
Oh, honey, isn't it thrilling?
Just my darned luck. I had to get across that balcony to that chest and waited until this man blew out the candles. But blasted, he left one burning.
And that left your shadow against the wall, eh?
That's just what happened. If it hadn't been for that, I'd be on my way now with the money. But I might have known I'd have bad luck. A big black cat crossed my path.
So you're superstitious too, Mr. Blodgett. Well, Jane, I guess you won't mind if I don't blow out all the candles on my next birthday cake.
No, dear. We won't blow them out at all. And I'll never be superstitious again.
So you see, gentlemen, I have good reason for not being superstitious.
San Francisco, all out for San Francisco.
And what happened to Blodgett?
Oh, he turned out to be a good old soul. I wanted to divide with him, but he said he was tired of roaming around and wanted to settle down. So he had me put his share in trust for our first baby. And you'll see him soon. There he is, sitting in my car. He's our chauffeur. And he's as happy as a seahorse in an aquarium.
There he is.
And there's Jane and the baby.
Hello, Jim.
Hi, Jane. And so tonight, Carter, if you don't blow out all the candles on your birthday cake, don't despair. There may be a Blodgett and $200,000 in loot lurking around. Well, so long. I'll be seeing you.
I am superstition. You don't believe, do you?
Thank you.
Okay. That's it for tonight. Here ends the dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions. I'm not going to go away quite yet. I'm going to spend the next few minutes listening to some music. Here we go.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done for me is to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah. Well, darkness has a hunger that's insatiable. And lightness has a call that's hard to hear. And I wrap my fear around me like a blanket. I sail my ship of safety till I sank it. I'm crawling on your shores. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find, yeah. Closer I am to find, yeah. And I went to see the doctor of philosophy with a poster of Rasputin and a beer down to his knee. He never did marry or see a big great movie. He graded my performance. He said he could see through me. I spent 4 years prostrate to the higher mind. Got my paper and I was free. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find, yeah. Closer I am to find, yeah. I stop by the bar at 3 a.m. to seek solace in a bottle or possibly a friend. I woke up with a headache like my head against a board. Twice as cloudy as I'd been the night before. And I went in seeking clarity. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountain. We go to the doctor. We go to the mountains. We look to the children. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find. Closer I am to find. Closer I am to find, yeah.
Guns and drums and drums and guns a-roop, a-roop. We're guns and drums and drums and guns a-roop, a-roop. We're guns and drums and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew ya.
Oh, Johnny lad, you do look bad. Ach, Johnny, I hardly knew you. With all your eyes that were so mild, a room, a room. With all your eyes that were so mild, a room, a room. Where are your eyes that were so mild when my heart ye first beguiled? Oh, why did you run from me and the child? Johnny, I hardly knew you. It's glad I am to see you home, a room, a room. It's glad I am to see you home, a room, a room. Glad I am to see you home, back from the island of Ceylon. So low in flesh, so high in bone, Johnny, I hardly knew. That used to run a room, a room. Where are your legs that used to run a room, a room? Where are your legs that used to run when first you went to carry a gun? You know your dancing days are done, Johnny, I hardly knew. You haven't an arm, you haven't a leg, a room, a room. You haven't an arm, you haven't a leg, a room, a room. You haven't an arm, you haven't a leg. You're a hopeless shell of a man on a peg, and you'll have to be put with your ball to beg. Ach, Johnny, I hardly knew. They're rolling out the guns again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the guns again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the guns again, but they'll never take my sons again. No, they'll never take my sons again. Johnny, I'm swearing to ya.
Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I could have. And maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should have. If I made you feel second best, girl, I'm sorry I was blind. You were always on my mind. You were always on my mind. And maybe I didn't hold you all those lonely, lonely times. I guess I never told you I'm so happy that you're mine. Little things I should have said and done, I just never took the time. But you were always on my mind. You were always on.